Hello, this is Dr. Flavio Guzman. Welcome to the Psychopharmacology Institute interviews. In this interview, we'll be discussing the topic of treatment-resistant depression with Dr. Prakash Massant. Dr. Massant is the CEO and founder of Global Medical Education. The topics we are going to address in this interview are the following. What is treatment-resistant depression? What does pseudoresistance mean in the context of treatment-resistant depression? The most important findings of the sequenced treatment alternatives to relieve depression, or STAR-D study. When to switch or augment antidepressants. Which drugs have the highest level of evidence as augmentation. And when to try MAOIs. So, Dr. Massant, we know that there are many definitions of treatment-resistant depression. Currently, which are the most accepted definitions?
There are two major classifications. One was put forward by Michael Thais when he was in Pittsburgh, and now he's at UPenn. And it has different levels of treatment resistance. So level one is failure to respond to one antidepressant trial. Level two is failure to respond to two antidepressant trials, usually from different classes. Level three, failure to respond to three. And then Maurizio Fava's group at the Mass General also had a classification where they have augmentation strategies which are incorporated into the levels. So instead of level two being failure to respond to two antidepressant trials, it would be failure to respond to either two antidepressant trials or one augmentation trial, and the same thing for level three and level four. Now, what is very interesting, as you probably know, is all these definitions of treatment resistance are based upon response. They're not based upon remission. So if you look at STAR-D and you look at what percentage of patients achieved remission with level one treatment in STAR-D, it was only about 30%. So three out of four patients in STAR-D would be considered to be treatment resistant at level one. And then if you even go all the way to level four in STAR-D, the number is about 40%. So 40% of patients after four levels of treatment were treatment resistant in the STAR-D trials, but their treatment resistance was defined as inability to achieve remission rather than just response.
So defining remission as?
So they defined remission either as a QIDS score, I think less than 7, or a MADRS score less than 10, or a HAM-D score less than 8. So typically they will use, most studies will use a HAM-D score of less than 7 or less than 8, or a MADRS, Montgomery-Åsberg Depression Rating Scale score of less than 10 as criteria for remission. But as a clinician, that usually equates to a greater than 75% improvement in symptoms, or what we would say a CGI-I of 1, very much improved. So I would say those are all synonymous. So either a CGI-I of 1, very much improved, greater than 75% improvement in symptoms, MADRS less than 10, or HAM-D less than 7.
I understand that the concept of pseudo-resistance is critical when assessing treatment-resistant depression. Could you explain us what does pseudo-resistance mean?
So pseudo-resistance refers to the fact that many patients who are considered to be treatment-resistant are not truly treatment-resistant because of confounding variables. For example, if somebody received an inadequate dose of the antidepressant or an inadequate duration of therapy, they would not be considered to be treatment resistant. That would be considered pseudo-resistance. If somebody is non-compliant with the medicines that were prescribed to them and they don't get better, that's not treatment resistance, that's pseudo-treatment resistance. If the patient is on other medications which interfered with the blood levels of the antidepressants, or the patient had a comorbid medical illness or comorbid substance abuse which was interfering with the response, then that may be another reason for pseudo-resistance. So pseudo-resistance really refers to not classifying patients as being treatment resistant when there are factors that interfere with the ability of the patient to get an adequate antidepressant trial.
We know that the STAR-D study addressed some real-world questions about the psychopharmacology of depression. Can you summarize some of the most relevant conclusions for clinical practice?
So, you know, STAR-D was a wonderful study. It was one of the largest studies in the world looking at major depression and psychopharmacology of major depression. But there were some important limitations, right? So one is STAR-D did not have a placebo control. Second, in STAR-D, the patients had the ability to choose which different arms they could be randomized to. So for example, if somebody didn't respond at level one to citalopram, and at level two, they could be switched to sertraline or bupropion or a venlafaxine, or they could be augmented with bupropion or buspirone or cognitive behavior therapy. The patient could choose and say, I only want to be randomized either to sertraline and bupropion, but I don't want to be randomized to venlafaxine. I don't want to be augmented with bupropion or buspirone, or I only want to be augmented with bupropion or buspirone. So this was a big problem, because the total number of patients in STAR-D who agreed to be randomized to whatever the algorithm was less than 1%. So that's another limitation. It's a limitation of STAR-D. But some people may argue that that's more clinically relevant, because in clinical practice, the clinician can present choices to the patient, and the patient says, okay, I'd like to try A, B, but not C or D for whatever reason. And so STAR-D was a real world trial, but you know, there are limitations to doing that, right? So basically what STAR-D found was, if you're treated with an SSRI citalopram monotherapy, you have about a 30 to 35% chance of achieving remission at the end of 12 weeks. And then if you fail citalopram, then if you're randomized to either bupropion, sertraline, or venlafaxine, you're equally likely to respond to each of those three. And if you're augmented with bupropion or buspirone or cognitive behavior therapy, the patients were too little, you are equally likely to respond to bupropion or buspirone augmentation of citalopram. And even though there were no statistically significant differences between augmentation and switch, the percentage of patients responding to augmentation was numerically higher compared to the patients who are switched. So one can reasonably argue that if you're a partial responder, you should be augmented. If you're a non-responder, you should be switched. And non-response is less than 25% improvement. Partial response is at least 25% improvement. And then in level three, the patients, you know, could be augmented with lithium or thyroid hormone, or could be, you know, switched to mirtazapine. And basically, again, they found that the patients who were, you know, switched or augmented did equally well, even though there was a numerically higher rate of persons responding to augmentation with lithium and thyroid compared to a switch. And then at level four, they could receive tranexamic parnate, which is an MAOI, or they could receive a combination of venlafaxine and mirtazapine at level four as the other treatment. I mean, level three, they could also get nortriptyline, which is a tricyclic antidepressant. They did equally well. So basically, what's the take-home message of STAR-D is this: if somebody doesn't respond to monotherapy SSRI, if they are a partial responder, you should probably augment. There's no difference amongst the augmentation strategies in terms of which works better. And if they do not respond even to level two, to another SSRI or SNRI, you should move on to other agents like mirtazapine or nortriptyline, because you will still get 15 to 20% of patients who will respond even at level three and level four.
That's interesting, because the next question I was going to ask you is whether is any data that can help decide between switching and augmenting. So a partial response is a useful guidance.
Right. And you know, there have not been, unfortunately, well-designed randomized control trials to test this in a large sample, right? So there hasn't been a large enough study. Now, you know, one could argue that STAR-D was one such study, right? But in STAR-D, I have not seen any data where they divided the patients at level one between partial responders and non-responders, and then showed that partial responders did better with augmentation and non-responders did better with switch. So this is an extrapolation from the percentage responders in level two and level three. What you will see is the numbers tend to be higher, and I'm willing to bet that if the sample size was larger at level two and level three, you would see that the augmentation did better than the switching. And my guess is, since, as I mentioned, STAR-D, the patients had the ability to choose between the different arms, my guess is the clinicians, you know, probably consciously or unconsciously may have said, you know, if you're a partial responder, why don't you choose some of the augmentation arms? And, you know, if you're a non-responder, you know, maybe you should be in the switch arm. You know, it's difficult to know. That was never measured. But you know, that's my guess, because the thinking in the field is partial responders do better with augmentation, non-responders do better with switch.
So augmentation strategies are effective. But are there any differences between drugs in terms of levels of evidence?
Sure. And the answer is yes. So, you know, that's a really good question, because STAR-D, unfortunately, didn't have a placebo arm. So, for example, in level two, if you were randomized to augmentation with buspirone and bupropion, and both of them worked equally well, what's to say that either one of them would do better than placebo? And in fact, the fact of the matter is there are no double-blind placebo-controlled trials of bupropion augmentation of SSRIs or tricyclic. So even though bupropion is used a lot by clinicians as an augmentation strategy, the evidence base is useless. There is no evidence base. It's only open-label studies. So the best evidence base for augmentation strategies, I would say, is for the atypical antipsychotics, particularly the ones that are FDA-approved, like aripiprazole, quetiapine, olanzapine, fluoxetine combination. They have the best evidence base amongst the atypicals. Then I would say the next best evidence base is lithium, but it's mainly with tricyclics, very little with SSRIs. T3, thyroid hormone, mixed evidence base, again, with tricyclics, with SSRIs, it actually doesn't look that good. And then I would say, one of the agents which recently there's been a good evidence base is lisdexamfetamine, which is Vyvanse. And the company did two double-blind randomized placebo-controlled trials that were presented last year, where it separated from placebo in one trial, and the pilot study, it met the predefined response criteria. So the company is now doing large phase three double-blind randomized placebo-controlled trials of lisdexamfetamine. Unfortunately, methylphenidate, extended release, and modafinil were negative in two double-blind control trials each. So one cannot presume that all psychostimulants are going to work, because methylphenidate did not work. We did one study, the first study, and there was another study done after us by Ravindran, and then there are two negative modafinil studies. So I would say lisdexamfetamine amongst the psychostimulants would be the agent of choice with the best evidence base, atypical antipsychotics, lithium, and then T3. And then there is some data for folate as an augmentation strategy. And then for the rest of them, I would say the evidence base is very little to none. Bupropion, buspirone, you know. The other thing I would say, cognitive behavior therapy, there's a good evidence base as an augmentation strategy. A recent large study and several studies have shown patients who are partial responders to SSRIs do well with the add-on of CBT. So I would say that's another evidence-based strategy that can be used.
Second-generation antipsychotics have good evidence, right?
Yes.
So, but the question someone might ask is, okay, how good is the risk-benefit ratio for these agents?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that is a really good point, and that's why I personally feel that the agents which have a better side effect profile should be preferred as an augmentation strategy. So, for example, I would say agents such as lisdexamfetamine, agents such as lithium, agents such as T3 should be tried before atypical antipsychotics because their risk-benefit ratio is better than atypical antipsychotics, which are likely to cause either akathisia, Parkinsonian side effects, weight gain, metabolic disturbances, prolactin elevation. So I agree with you. I think the risk-benefit ratio is in favor of trying agents with a good evidence base and a beneficial side effect profile rather than agents that have side effects that are more problematic.
You also said that the evidence from for lithium augmentation is based on trials that used tricyclics as a combination. Are there any ongoing trials for lithium and newer antidepressants that you're aware of?
I think there were some small trials of lithium augmentation with SSRIs, but to my knowledge, there have been no large studies of lithium augmentation with SSRIs. Now, one can argue that STAR*D was one such trial because at level three you could get lithium or T3, but STAR*D didn't have a placebo arm, right? So we are talking about double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trials. To my knowledge, there are no large studies underway of lithium augmentation of SSRIs. At least I'm not aware of any. So the lithium data in terms of augmentation is more robust for tricyclic augmentation than SSRI augmentation.
About MAOIs, what is your personal view about when clinicians should try them besides atypical depression?
As I pointed out in STAR*D, MAOIs were level four, right? And I think that's reasonable for MAOIs to be level four, unless the patient has an atypical depression, as you pointed out, where one could make a reasonable argument that it should be a level three, or maybe in some people a level two. Because the data for atypical depression shows, if you look at the evidence base, that MAOIs are superior to tricyclics. There are a few small studies comparing MAOIs to SSRIs, but the MAOI that was compared was moclobemide, which is not a non-specific MAOI, which showed moclobemide was equal to SSRIs. But one could argue, and I think there's merit to the argument, that tranexamfetamine and phenazine are more efficacious than moclobemide, which incidentally is not available in the US. It's available in Canada. I don't know whether it's available in Argentina. But I would argue that in atypical depression, the non-specific MAOIs, tranexamfetamine or phenazine or even the sertraline patch should be considered earlier in the algorithm than a level four because the data are pretty clear that tricyclics don't work and the efficacy of the SSRIs is limited. And even augmentation strategies, there are no good studies in atypical depression with augmentation strategies with lithium, T3, atypical antipsychotics, or psychostimulants.
What has your experience been in terms of adherence to MAOIs?
So I think if you do good education of the patient, I find that the adherence with the MAOIs is as good as it is with the SSRIs or the SNRIs. Particularly if they are a candidate for the sertraline transdermal patch, then that's good, in terms of adherence also. But the other thing is, I think the main focus when you prescribe MAOIs is to address the anxieties that the patients may have around the drug-drug interactions and the food interactions, and give them a very simple, chart of foods they can eat and they need to avoid so that they don't feel anxious when they have to decide between foods and medicines because the list is not that extensive, quite honestly. So I think if you educate the patient in treatment-resistant depression, the adherence rate I would say are no different with MAOIs than they are with SSRIs or SNRIs.
So one clinical question is for how long do you maintain the augmentin agent?
There have been very few studies to address this question of augmentation because the augmentation trials typically tend to be 8 weeks, 12 weeks. There was one very interesting study done with lithium. So they took patients who responded to lithium augmentation of SSRIs, and they randomized them to stay on the combination of SSRI and lithium or switch over to SSRI plus placebo over a 4 month period. And the relapse rate when switched to placebo was, you know, almost 30-40%, and lithium continuation, it was like 10%. So that's one study that shows that you have to continue it at least for 4 months. But clinically, my belief is that the dose and the combination that gets you better keeps you better, and you should stay on the combination for as long as you need to be on the antidepressant. So, you know, I look at treatment-resistant depression like hypertension or diabetes. And we often use a combination of medicines for hypertension or diabetes. And once the blood pressure is under control or the blood sugar is under control, the endocrinologist or the cardiologist does not say, let me stop one of the medicines now that you're feeling all better. And I think we should do the same thing for TRD, is whatever it takes to get you better, the dose and the combination is what you should stay on for the maintenance period. And the maintenance period could be 1 year for first episode, 2 years for second episode, and lifelong for three or more episodes. Treat it as almost as if you're giving them a combination drug, which is getting them all better, and they need that to stay better. Because, you know, the kind of a good rule of thumb is, you know, the dose and the combination that gets you better keeps you better.
So finally, what is your take-home message for our colleagues?
So, you know, the most important message, I think, for clinicians is make sure you make the correct diagnosis. Make sure you rule out bipolar depression. Make sure you rule out substance abuse or comorbid medical illnesses. Make sure the patient is compliant. Make sure the patient gets an adequate dose for an adequate duration. And then be patient and try different strategies, because you'll be surprised that people that you gave up as being treatment resistant, I've had patients who responded after 8 trials or 9 trials, and then they stayed well for years and years and years. So you should never give up, because with the medicines, with ECT, with RTMS, with deep brain stimulation, we have a lot of options. And I would say with all these options, 90% of patients will get better. They may not achieve remission, but they will have a response. So You should always persevere, because I think that in this day and age, with all the options that we have, we can help the vast majority of patients with MDD to get better. You have to have a good therapeutic alliance. The patient and you have to form a good team. But, you know, if you're positive and you give the patient hope, the patient will hang in there. Very often what happens is the clinician's unconscious message may be, this is a hopeless case, you're not going to get better. Then the patient also gives up hope. So I think as a clinician, you should be hopeful, because there are so many treatments available and you can help the vast majority of your patients. And I think that's a very important determinant of patient motivation, is hope. It's always, you know, everybody loves to be hopeful.
So, doctor, as a final thought, we know that you're into a project called Global Medical Education.
Yes.
Would you like to talk a little bit about the future of the project? And...
Sure. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. So Global Medical Education is a project that I started more than a year ago. And we invited 20 of the top psychiatrists in America, from Duke, where I worked for many years, Harvard, Mass General, Stanford, Columbia, University of Oxford. And our goal was to create an online library of 700 videos that answers every clinical question in psychiatry by the experts in an evidence-based manner and a very clinician-friendly manner. So any healthcare professional who's treating any psychiatric illness anywhere in the world, if they have a question related to any diagnosis, any treatment, psychotherapy, substance abuse, ECT, RTMS, DBS, child and adolescent psychiatry, geriatric psychiatry, one of the world's experts will answer that question in a video in 3 minutes or 4 minutes, and it's all evidence-based. And you know, we put it on our website, global medical education, gmed.com. And Flavio, you know, what I would love to do for your readers and your audience is if they can go to our Facebook page, which we have, it's on our website, Global Medical Education. And if they can just like our page, they can get free access to the website by entering the discount code Facebook. So they can just go to our Facebook page, like our page, then go to the website, enter the discount code Facebook, and they can get free access to the website. You know, normally we charge $99 a year for a subscription, but I'm happy to do it for your viewers.
This was Dr. Prakash Masand, CEO and founder of Global Medical Education, discussing the topic of treatment-resistant depression. I hope you find this interview useful, and you can visit psychopharmacologyinstitute.com for more videos and audio on psychopharmacology and psychiatry. Thanks.